to the whole wedding ceremony. So the bridegroom, throughout the Bible, we find this analogy, this metaphor of a wedding, this metaphor of relationship, of an intimate relationship being described. We have it in the Old Testament between God and the nation of Israel. This idea that God or Jesus is the bridegroom and his people are the bride. So in the Old Testament, who would be the bride? Anybody? Just guess. Israel, perfect. So when God is talking in the Old Testament, you see repeatedly, they have forsaken me, they've committed adultery, they've left their first love, they've abandoned me. It's like a lover who's been forsaken. In the New Testament, Jesus continues this metaphor of this marriage analogy with him as the bride and he's the bridegroom. Paul develops this quite a bit, the Apostle Paul. This idea that the church, those who are committed to following Jesus' way, are now making up the people of God who are the bride. So we've got this metaphor going on of bride and bridegroom. Isn't it interesting that the very first miracle we read about in John is Jesus at a wedding? An echo that Jesus likes this idea, that there's this sense of, yeah. Now, I know that many of us have been to weddings here, and many of us here have been married. But it's interesting to me that John the Baptist even continues this idea of weddings, an analogy of weddings. And when you think about a wedding, it's interesting because there's lots of stuff going on in a wedding. We were at a wedding just a couple of weeks ago, and after the ceremony, what happens? Usually after the ceremony, what happens? A reception. Good. But do we really, I mean, we all call it a reception, but you know what it really is? It's a party, baby. Right? You get to eat. Isn't that fantastic? And usually, you don't have to pay for it. Unless you're the father of the bride. We've had a couple of weddings at a year apart. But it's a party, right? It's fun. At the end of the eating, what do? There's often like speeches and camaraderie and there's dancing. It's amazing. It's a party. And Jesus got invited to the party. So a couple of echoes before I get going on that, because I think it's really cool. We don't think of Jesus in that context of a party very often. A couple of other thoughts as I read through the portion that are metaphors or echoes that I can draw out here. There's probably several if we spent more time thinking about it, but I don't want to take a whole lot of time. Transforming the water. When Jesus transforms the water into wine, and the last of the text, it says it was a sign. That it was a sign. This sign was the sign that Jesus was completely transforming the existing religious system. Transforming the Jewish religious system. It's a sign that there was this huge change coming. There was a complete transformation. You see, the Jewish religion had started it back at Sinai. Remember we were at Sinai for at the beginning of this message series? And we saw Moses and the water from the rock, right? Sinai was the place where God said, here's what you need to do to be close to me. Here's how you will be identified as my bride. Moses started all of these things, and there's the Ten Commandments, and there's these rules that they had. Here's what you need to do to be ceremonial clean. Here's the ways you need to sacrifice. Here's how you need to interact with me. Make a little place where we will meet called the Tent of Meeting, and we have the Ark of the Covenant. We have all of these things. There's this religious system that was instituted in Moses. Now that, at the time of this wedding in Cana, that was already like 2,500 years previous. So over that time, this religious system that God started had begun to calcify, to get very strict and hard. Does that sound familiar to anybody who's familiar with religious stuff? Over time, isn't that what we normally do? We sort of get the letter of the law and the spirit of the law all mixed up. And so the Jews were no different. And so over that extended period of time from Moses, all the religious rules had become really, really specific. And Jesus, doing this symbol, this sign of transforming water into wine, was a symbol that there was a new thing coming. It was a revolutionary event that sort of transforms the way people will relate to God. So in effect, Jesus is taking the water, the religious rules that people were drinking, right? And then he transforms them into something completely different. His death and resurrection will completely change how God will interact with people, and no longer is it going to be about a religious set of rules, but rather about an intimate friendship, much like a marriage. In fact, this new wine that would be the new relationship with God would be even better than the previous one. This new way of interacting with God would be even better than the previous way of interacting with God. So these are sort of a couple of the things that that kind of light bulbs that came on as I read through this passage this past week. There's this idea that there's this transformative thing, this new way of interfacing with God, this new relationship mode. So as we look at this passage and we see the story progress, I wanted to kind of maybe touch base on a couple of the things that we can take away for us. So the first one is, following Jesus isn't boring. I know that we know people in church, and if you're investigating religious things, you know people like this who are boring. It just seems that you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do all this stuff, you can't. But I want you to know something from this passage. Following Jesus is not boring. And if it is boring, you're not close enough. If following Jesus for you is boring, you're not close enough to Jesus. I want you to imagine what those servants were saying when they're filling up this cup and serving this wine. This isn't water anymore. How is that happening? And I'm sure there was just all of this awe and wonder around all of this. And it's a cool thing to me that Jesus takes water and makes it into wine. I know we have present day sensitivities around alcohol. And I'm not really wanting to take some time this morning and go into something like that. But I find it fun that Jesus is at a wedding party and he actually makes more wine. Because you see, Jesus is okay with the party. He understands that there's some fun that can be had. He understands that there's this celebration that needs to continue. It's not something where we need to be glum and boring, restrict ourselves. Because following Jesus can be something where we have good, clean fun. If it's not, you're probably so far behind Jesus that by the time you arrive, the party's over, and no wonder you think it's boring. The second thing that I kind of came in my mind, or a thought I had as we go through this passage, is Jesus cares about every aspect of our lives. We talked about this last week. He's okay with the little things, right? But Jesus actually cared about things like this. It's a little thing. Weddings back then were massive events. It's not like today where it's like a day-long affair. Unless you're the parents of the bride and groom, which it sometimes can go on longer. But it's not a day-long affair then. The best way I can describe it for us that maybe we can connect with is weddings back in that day were similar to our Indo-Canadian neighbors' weddings. So it was multiple days. There was tents, there was partying, there was lots of food, there was lots and lots of people. It was a big, big thing. Jewish weddings were and are a really huge deal in Jewish culture. And actually, the wedding ceremony would take place late in the evening after a huge time of feasting. The father of the bride would take his daughter on his arm, and together with the wedding party in tow, they would parade through the streets of the village. And there would be laughing, and there would be singing, and there would be celebration. There was this incredible spirit of a party as they would go through the village, through the streets of the village, so that everybody there could actually come out and congratulate the bride on this momentous event, this incredibly fun event. And likely in a village, as they went by, people would come out, and it would just be assumed they're invited. Can you imagine being the caterer? How many are coming?
I don't know. I think everybody.
Yeah, but everybody, you mean what? Well, like Chilliwack. Okay, well, maybe not that, because Cana was not that. Cana was small. Cana was like Popcom. Maybe even smaller. But everybody was coming. So finally, the wedding party would arrive at the home of the groom, and the wedding ceremony actually took place in the front door of the groom's house. And after the ceremony, the bride and groom would then walk through the streets again, and people would be lighting the streets with torches, there would be a canopy, there would be singing, there would be just this huge celebration of this incredibly awesome event called a wedding, called marriage. And they would all go through and take the longest route through the village, so that as many of people as possible could wish them well. It was a huge celebration. And for this culture, there was no such thing as a honeymoon. The couple kept an open house for a week. And they were treated like royalty. They were dressed in fancy clothes. And many times they would have like wardrobe changes. It was better than the Oscars. And they would have like crowns on their heads, and they would just be this incredible celebration and an incredible affirmation of what was going on. In those days, the groom's family was expected to provide all the food. I was born several centuries too late. Two weddings in 2 years. That's lots. The groom's family is expected to provide the refreshments for this whole week-long party. And here we are in the middle of this incredible celebration, and they run out of wine. The wine that they run out of isn't like someone in the back popping the corks and dumping bottles into a big pitcher or anything like that. What they often did was just they would let the grape juice ferment, and then they would add water and dilute it as they go. And the master of ceremonies, the party manager, the wedding planner, if you will, his job was to keep the party going and to help let that wine last so that he would dilute it more and more throughout the event so that it would last longer. So the really good wine was always served first, but here Jesus comes to this party. He's a guest. He and his friends have been invited. But we get the sense that Mary was maybe a friend of the family, maybe similar to what we might understand as like a godmother or an aunt. We don't have any clarity around that. But somehow Mary has this information at her disposal that they've run out of wine. That the party has run out of stuff to drink. I would completely be mortified if at our wedding receptions, food ran out. There was nothing to drink. We had to scramble and find like water. That would just be embarrassing. And so Mary comes to Jesus with the problem. And I love this part of the text. If you go back and look at it, it starts at verse 3. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine. They have no more wine." This conversation that we listen in on here reminds me of a typical mom conversation. Doesn't it? And in my imagination, I put Mary with like a thick Jewish accent. "My son, they have no more wine. The wine is gone." And can you imagine Jesus standing there listening to his mother? Now, when we read the English text here, verse 4 says, "Woman, why do you involve me?" And we put a certain tone on that. We're in our Western culture, and we're like, "Woman, what are you involving me for?" That's not what Jesus was saying. It's not that. I am in my imagination, Mary has brought Jesus over to where the servants are, off to the side. There's a big party going on. She goes, "Hey, this, my son, there's no more wine." I know that kind of sounds like The Godfather, sorry. But she's telling him that there's no more wine, sort of off to the side. And I think the reason she does that, if you remember, at Christmas time, we talk about the Christmas story when Jesus is born. And as we hear Mary being told the news she's expecting, and this will be a great and momentous event, that her son will be Emmanuel. He will rescue his people. He will be the King of Kings. She hears all these things. At the very end of that story, what does the text tell us that Mary does? She hides these things in her heart. She remembers them. She knows the secret. So I kind of think as his mom, he's older now, and she comes up and she goes, and it would be hugely embarrassing for this family. The word there, woman, if you take it out of the original languages, it's a term of respect. It's sort of like a medieval term of m'lady or ma'am. He's intentionally sort of making this distance now. He's older, and his mission hasn't quite started yet. And so he says, "But ma'am, this isn't our concern." If you look in the book called The Message I was talking about earlier, Eugene Peterson, he translates it this way. "Is that any of our business, Mom? Yours or mine? This isn't my time. Don't push me." Jesus was well aware of the timetable. He was well aware of his mission. He was well aware of what he was there to accomplish. And so he knew that this moment was probably significant for them, but this was not the right moment to start his mission, to start his ministry. His time wasn't right yet. Mom, not yet. Has your teenager ever said that to you? Mom, not right yet. Not now. Can you do that later? And that ties us to the third point I want to draw out this morning. Jesus didn't do this to bring attention to himself. What I mean is that Jesus wasn't about doing these miraculous things to go, "Hey, look, I'm here. I'm the Son of God. Look at, I proved it. We just got water into wine, people. Oh, look it. I'm going to raise this guy up from the dead. Well, that girl is not sick anymore. Oh, look it. You're healed from leprosy. Yay, me." That's not what Jesus was doing. That's never what Jesus' MO was throughout any of the things that happened. Jesus was not about drawing attention to himself. It wasn't the point that he draws attention to himself. Now, people are going to notice. I'm sure the servants recognized something strange is going on. This lady, who's like a really close family friend, apparently, we guess, I'm assuming.
No.
told her son to do to follow his instructions. He said, fill up these ceremonial jugs, Jewish religious jugs, with water, and then serve that. Ew. And it turns out to be the best wine of the whole week. They knew. They noticed. But Jesus was never going, hey, look at me. Look, see what I did? Later in John's gospel, he talks about how he only does what the Father asks him to do. If you've got a pen and you want to maybe read something this week, jot on the side there, John chapter 14. Read the whole chapter. John chapter 14, it's in the book of John. But I want you to pay special attention to verses 10 to 14. And just think about that over the course of this next week. You might also want to step a little further through John to chapter 17, starting at verse 6 to the end of the chapter. I'm not going to go into those, but jot them down on your notes. John 17, because Jesus is wanting us to know that this is about God. It's not a neat trick that's going to get him fame or notoriety. He is obeying what God is asking him to do. And he in John 17, he's praying for you. So cool. And finally, the last thing that I take away from this small story about the wedding party and the wine, Jesus saves the best for last. He saved the best for last. Isn't it interesting that the party manager, the wedding planner, the master of ceremonies, the guy who's helping organize the party says, hey, why did you save the best wine till now? Another one of those echoes. It was okay to try and meet God on his terms in the Jewish religious system. But now is a better way. Now is a better way. So the implications for us as we think about this is that as we choose to live Jesus' way, it means that life's not going to be boring. It'll be an adventure. And as we learn to hear him clearly and we obey much more regularly, we can have confidence that the best is still yet to come. I know we've talked about this before, that we live in a war zone in our world today. The battle of sin was won at the cross. It was decisive. That war is won. But we're still living in a battle zone where there are skirmishes that happen, where the consequences and effects of sin still are all around us. But one day Jesus will return to set things right. He was going to come and he will make right all of creation. It will be the inauguration of a brand new government, a brand new experience that will be better than you could even imagine. Oh, right now there are things that may not be so great. We've all had them, and some of us are in the middle of them. But a time's coming. The best is still coming. Because with Jesus as my friend, Jesus as your friend, we can have that confidence that when Jesus sets his kingdom up here on earth and renovates creation and banishes the effects of sin once and for all, he will be our king. In fact, he will be our friend. That idea, that marriage analogy that we talked about as a metaphor, will actually come to pass. We'll get to be together, and it'll be real. It won't be this thing we try to figure out in our head. It'll be real. So the parting thought I want to leave with you this morning, don't be bored. Don't be bored. Get close to Jesus. If you're finding that you're bored, then you're too far away. Get close to him. Step into that friendship. Step into his way of looking at the world, of walking through this world. thank you. Next week, we're going to be finishing up the series Water for Life, another story from the book of John, another one of my favorite ones, but you don't want to miss it. Let's pray.